Are you a coffee lover? And are you settling for nothing but the best coffee? Maybe you enjoy gourmet coffee brands from your local grocer or cafe. But did you know that the high-end coffee brands promising you the best cup of joe are imposters? Imposters! Kill it with fire! Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but it is a fact that most coffee, even expensive gourmet brands, are skipping the most important step in bringing you a truly exceptional cup of coffee in your own home, and that's delivering freshly roasted beans. But you don't have to wait until spring for rescue. Just switch to Sparkplug Coffee today. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery for the forgetful among us. And for top 100 listeners, Sparkplug is offering a special if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. Sparkplug will give you 10% off any size coffee order. Perhaps you've already switched to Sparkplug. No matter, Sparkplug will still honor the code. Though, heads up, while this promo applies to any size coffee order, it does not apply to any of the gear that they offer. So what are you waiting for? Stop settling for the imposter! Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action!
Hiya, aliens from a far-off world who crash-land in the shittiest place possible, and thanks for downloading the Next 100 Project. Our podcast gets all up in the business of reviewing classic Flickr shows. You should fear us if you fear spoilers. I'm the very cold scientist who does wacky things at the South Pole, and with me on this fucking couch is my shape-shifting wife, Bev.
That's me.
One of my favorite lines in this movie, one of the few great laughs in this movie. So the coming attractions trivia for The Thing. At the end of the movie, is Kurt Russell The Thing, is Keith David The Thing, or is neither of them The Thing?
I have a really long answer. So, my first instinct was, I don't know. You don't know. Childs and MacReady don't know. That's the point. But then I went down the rabbit hole a little, and now I'm pretty convinced that Childs is The Thing. Because number one, you can see MacReady's breath, but not Childs's. Number two, Childs was missing for a long time, so there was definitely an opportunity. Number three, MacReady can't act on it because Childs still has that flamethrower pointed right at him. There's still only two more. There's a theory that MacReady, who doesn't drink from the whiskey bottle himself, gives the whiskey to Childs, who drinks it. So the theory is that the whiskey was actually gasoline that he was going to make a Molotov cocktail with. He was giving it to Childs to test him. Childs drinks it, and as he takes the swig from it, the music kicks in. MacReady has this kind of weird laugh out of nowhere, and the insinuation was that MacReady in that moment knows that Childs is The Thing, but there's nothing he can really do about it. I guess he could, like, kill himself and kill them both with fire, but they decide to end the movie there. But I think the most convincing evidence that Childs is, in fact, The Thing is that on the DVD commentary, the cinematographer, Dean Cundey, confessed to a lighting trick that they used to differentiate between humans and aliens. Humans get an eye light, and The Thing doesn't. And Childs does not have an eye light in that last scene.
Excellent answer all across the board.
Told you it was a long one.
I have one thing to add to that that I read online, and I tried to look for it. I watched this just a few hours ago to confirm the laugh you talked about where Kurt Russell gives that whole sort of, I got you now, but too tired to do anything about it. But it also says online that Keith David's earring, or earrings? Earring, I think, is still in his ear. And when The Thing redoes you, it doesn't actually make earrings.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't see the earring, but that's what I read.
Is
but
that either canon? It can't recreate earrings? Because it can recreate clothes.
It also can recreate heart conditions. Norris has the heart condition, and the doctor blasts right through his chest.
It looks like he's dying of a heart attack, or maybe a heart attack is just what finally kills you when there's an alien parasite reorganizing your organs and bones.
But that's not Norris, that's The Thing now.
But maybe that's just a stage of what The Thing goes through.
Alright, fine.
Anyway, or a strain on his heart was ready to go and then that set it off or something.
Okay. good job on the answer. You handled it very well, and I really can't add much more to it. So that's great stuff. I never picked up on that stuff for the longest time until I saw this movie on Blu-ray and was reading the trivia, and that was on there on the IMDb, but it wasn't on there years before that I remember seeing. And that's a great twist that you don't actually know, or maybe don't even think about it, because who cares? They're dead, or they're the thing. They're not winning. They're not getting out of there.
No, we should absolutely care. They make the point very clearly that what the thing would want to do most is find somewhere to just freeze, because he can obviously freeze and defrost, and a rescue crew would come to investigate and see what happened, and when they did that, they would almost definitely bring these bodies back to the mainland, and then that would be time for the thing to take over Earth. So if MacReady doesn't kill Childs, then the thing wins. He will eventually win.
But the movie doesn't actually answer that question. I think it's pretty good that they don't.
Yeah, I kind of like it better that it doesn't. And I like it better that they stuck with a very bleak ending, because as we'll discuss, there were definitely opportunities to give it a happy ending. But I think that the bleak ending is probably what elevates it to its classic level.
The line he has before they have the big showdown at the end, "We're not getting out of here alive," could have been a top 100 quote. It's a very simple quote, but that is pretty nihilistic. We're not winning this fight, yeah. Really. We might beat this thing, but we're not going to survive, at least, this fight.
If you think about it, the person who should have been in charge, the person who was right all along, was Blair. Because Blair wanted to destroy the entire base and everyone in it. Mm. He knew that they were doomed. He knew they didn't have a chance. He knew the only way to save humanity was for them to all go with the thing, with fire. Unfortunately, he goes completely haywire and destroys everything in the most, like, dramatic fashion. What he should have done was called a meeting, put all the dynamite. Why is there dynamite? Well, there's a lot of...
Why are there weapons? Yeah. Why are guns in the South Pole on a science expedition?
What research exactly are you accomplishing? Because you have this really eclectic collection of tools, which include weapons, dynamite, a lot of gasoline, a helicopter, the dog team.
Flamethrowers?
What do you need flamethrowers for? Yeah, you have all those things, and you have, like, doctors and technicians. Oh, and the computer that plays chess, which apparently is not essential because MacReady kills it in the first scene.
With his booze.
Yeah.
And the only female in the whole movie is the voice on his machine, which would be Adrienne Barbeau, Carpenter's wife. Although one theory I had when I wrote that down about how that's the only woman in the whole film, the voice on the computer, what if the thing is female?
Thing could absolutely be female, probably because it's more of a group of individual cells. It's more likely an asexual creature.
Well, if it's a woman, I'll say this. Get away from them, you bitch!
Well, speaking of the word bitch, there's only one, as you say, female character in the movie, and that's the voice of the computer. She outsmarts MacReady, macho MacReady, at chess, and then he calls her a bitch and murders her with whiskey. Not a nice movie to be a female, I suppose.
Even though the previous movie we covered has a woman protagonist and antagonist, and our movie next week will have a woman protagonist and arguably the antagonist. But anyway, let's get back into The Thing and the usual stuff we cover at this point. The Next 100 Project's 80th movie film, The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, didn't get AFI love of any kind, not a single nomination in any category. I don't think it even got one in the sci-fi category of the top 100 genres. I looked and I didn't see anything like that. Universal released the picture a little over 35 years ago on June 25th, 1982. Despite working with a bigger budget than most horror movies had at the time, it was not a success. It didn't help that it came out 2 weeks after its polar opposite, E.T. In fact, people say that's one of the big reasons why The Thing didn't succeed, because here's the nice alien, we love this one, it's great, we have to see this movie over and over again. But The Thing, no, not The Thing, it's terrible. And I said horror movie, of course it's sci-fi, it's horror, it's a lot of different things, really. Well, anyway, Bev, explain this movie after all this time. Maybe it's kind of pointless now, but anyway, this skinny.
Kurt Russell is MacReady, a pilot spending the winter cooped up with a team of scientists in a remote Antarctic research base. Following a strange encounter with some Norwegian neighbors and their dog, the base gets infected with a nefarious alien creature that can quickly and convincingly assume the form of any other living creature, including any of the men sharing this increasingly claustrophobic space. With few ways to tell who's real and who's an imposter, the only thing more dangerous than this alien invader is paranoia.
Paranoia, the motion picture. Or, in a nutshell, A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yes! I have my own nutshell this week. Alien, without all those dizzy broads.
Dizzy dames?
Yes.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on The Thing. 82% of critics like the film, 47 fresh, 10 rotten, and 92% of audiences. So pretty solid numbers there. And it's 164th on the IMDb's 250. It was 42nd at the 1982 U.S. box office. The aforementioned E.T. was number one. The Thing is like the Borg. It assimilates its victims. That's an interesting little comparison to another sci-fi film. And it's filled with paranoia. Are you infected? Do you have AIDS? Oh, it's also a metaphor for age, but John Carpenter did say that's not what they were going for. Anyway, after all this time, what'd you think of The Thing? Thumb up, thumb down.
I don't know if I would put The Thing on my list of best horror films ever made or anything, but I definitely think it belongs in the conversation. I'm a little surprised at just how high esteem some people hold it in, so maybe it's not totally my jam, but goddamn, it's so fun.
Carpenter's viewed better now than he was when his movies came out. Maybe Halloween was liked right away by everybody. It was a huge hit, of course, but it was actually pretty respected by critics, as I believe, then, and certainly is now. You didn't like it, but most people did.
And I'm making a face.
But Escape from New York was, I think, for a lot of people then, especially critics. This movie was another film he's made, and that was that run he had of Halloween and the Elvis TV movie with Kurt Russell playing Elvis and The Fog, which is okay. And then Escape from New York and this. And even Starman a few years later with Jeff Bridges. The only Oscar nomination in any John Carpenter movie ever was Best Actor for Jeff Bridges. But it was a hell of a run for him. I'm a big fan of the movie. I'm not as big a fan as a lot of people are because this movie is pretty beloved online. But I think it's a damn good film. The score was nominated for a Razzie.
I know!
Ennio Morricone. It's a great music score. It's so understated. I'm sure you like that about it. And somehow that makes it a Razzie.
I mean, I don't like score, but I love Ennio Morricone. He's one of the few composers that I actually like to listen to the movie scores just on their own. I'm not typically a person that enjoys movie scores without the context of the film, but I love his scores. And it's a horror film. Like, it's appropriate to have a nice, dramatic, creepy score like this. I think that's just part of the movie catching a lot of flack when it first came out. I was alarmed at how negative some of the reviews are. A lot of reviewers that we like, including Roger Ebert, who just thought it was too gory and too nihilistic, and this is probably fair, too much of a ripoff of other films of the time, most notably Alien. We watched this so soon after we did the podcast for Alien, and it is remarkable watching these movies close together, just how much The Thing is beat for beat, kind of copying the tone and the notes of Alien, of people being cooped up in a small space just trying to survive. Of course, it goes to a different place because it's more about paranoia and it's more about macho posturing in a way that Alien doesn't really dive into. But the notion of this crew, this almost antagonistic crew, having to survive against an alien who's violent and gross and terrifying, and there's nowhere they can go.
Well, in this movie, you don't know who's who, and an alien, you always do.
Yeah, that's the one thing that The Thing does remarkably different, and that makes it stand out. I can see why people said, we've already seen this.
Well, the beginning of the film, of course, is the dog running from the helicopter, and it begs the question, unless it got one hell of a good head start, how in the world is it ahead of a helicopter? They should be able to find it and track it down pretty fast. But you could argue it got a big head start, I guess.
And it's not a dog, it's an alien.
But still, it's running like a dog.
We have no idea what they're capable of. What a great opening, too, because who among us isn't profoundly horrified by the image of a dog being chased and shot at by men in a helicopter? It's effective, disconcerting way to begin the film and to make the audience like immediately super uncomfortable about where they're going. And it's a great mystery to solve. What circumstances possibly could have made this happen? Why would they be chasing the dog? What the hell is going on? And solving mysteries is a big part of the fun of the first act. But then the second time you watch the film, you have to sit with the knowledge that all these men could be saved if they just, and humanity could be saved if they just shot that dog dead right there. If they just trusted the men in the helicopter, there was a good reason to kill this dog.
Apparently the language the Norwegians are speaking is to warn our heroes about the dog. They're trying to say, no, it's not a dog. Get away from it. And right away it touches that one guy who I don't think is the first one that becomes the thing, Fuchs, but it's all over that dude. And you could argue that as soon as the thing touches you in any kind of way, you're infected. Again, a play on AIDS, but that was not supposedly a John Carpenter intention. Because, of course, AIDS doesn't get you that easily. Although people thought in the early 80s, if you just touch a guy with AIDS or a woman with AIDS, you're going to get it, so
the reason that you can easily debunk that this movie is remotely about AIDS is that when they were making the film, They didn't even know about AIDS. You knew about it if you were part of the gay community, but the average Joe, the average heterosexual bro in Hollywood...
It's Hollywood.
Well, yeah, okay, good point. But John Carpenter, is he really going to make a movie about the AIDS epidemic in the
No, and that's why he probably denied it.
Yeah.
But there is that big blood test, one of the best scenes in the whole film, which we'll get to a little later. So in the scene with the dog at the beginning, it's another half an hour before that dog goes loco. And I've noticed that in movies like this, horror, sci-fi, especially sci-fi horror films, it's around the half-hour mark that vital stuff starts happening. It was true in Get Out, and it's been true in other horror films I've watched recently that aren't going to be reviewed by us for this podcast. And then when the dog does go haywire, it's a great special effects, and there's some incredible makeup by Rob Bottin. They use the flamethrowers. There's lots of fire in this film. Of course, that's why it's A Song of Ice and Fire. And there's a nice contrast to the snowy environment. If they were just in L.A. or a desert or something, it wouldn't be quite as strong a contrast as the ultimate fire versus the ultimate cold, especially in Antarctica, where they should be freezing to death the minute they go outside without proper protection. And by the way, speaking of fire, they use the burned American camp at the end of the film to double for the Norwegian camp when they go inspect that. And here's a reasonably good question. Why does the doctor, of all people, go on a dangerous field trip? Is he like Jack and Lost?
Let me add another reasonably good question. Why is it okay for the pilot to be drunk? Day and night. He drinks Jim Beam like it's his job.
I don't know. What else are you going to do up there?
They introduce him drinking Jim Beam, like, in the morning or whatever time it is. And then he's like, yeah, I'll fly that helicopter too. No, I've got this.
He seems competent enough. They do get back. They don't die in helicopters at all. You mentioned Blair's freak out, which just happened a little after the dog thing and whatnot. He sabotages everything, but I wonder if that's just a ploy by the Thing, because it's been argued. Is the Thing inside of him at that point? Now, what you said a few minutes ago probably is accurate and probably would suggest that he doesn't have the Thing inside of him. But is that also just him acting out with the Thing inside? I don't know. It's been speculated both ways.
Well, presumably you would be infected with the Thing for at least a little incubation period before it took over your mind and affected your behavior. Actually, it insinuates it gestates, and then it doesn't really take over you until it fully replaces you. So it would shed your body, replace it with its own body that's assumed your form. Which is what,
torn up clothes.
Yeah. So Blair is still Blair at that point. He may realize that he's already infected. He may have already put that together, and that's why he's willing to kind of go on this suicide mission, because he knows he's doomed anyway.
What's suicide mission?
Well, he's destroying the radio. He's trying to wreck the base. He wants them to be trapped
there. Oh, I thought for a minute you thought he went over to the Norwegian camp, but that's not him that goes over there. But okay, fine.
I get them mixed up. One of the things that bugs me
the doctor
is there are too many characters. There's a dozen of them in that base, 11 or 12. I've seen the movie 3 times, and I always get confused about Richard, who's who and, like, what their names are. I can never keep their names
Richard straight. Dysart is the doctor, and he goes with Kurt Russell over to the other camp.
But Blair is a scientist. He's the one that puts
Wilford Brimley. I think everyone knows Wilford Brimley. Cocoon, the Quaker Oats pitch man, the diabetes commercials. He's Blair. So they're two different guys. And then Norris is the one...
But he does the autopsy. Blair does the autopsy, doesn't he?
On the alien, but the doctor is the one who gets his arms cut off when he's trying to treat Norris, who has the heart condition.
You know, Alien keeps it down to, what, 7 characters? How many people are there?
I think it's 8 or so, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Somehow that seems more manageable. And maybe because there's different genders and there's different races in the Thing, too. But I don't know. There's something about Alien where it felt really easy to keep everybody straight. I get so confused every time when I'm watching the Thing.
It doesn't help that there aren't any stars apart from Kurt Russell in the whole movie. Well, Brimley maybe, but no one else in the movie is really any kind of player before or since. A lot of actors, I'll name them in a little while, but who really knows who the hell they are?
Yeah, that's a good point. So Blair's suicide mission is to take all of them with him. And there's no way that the Thing would want that to happen, because what the Thing wants to do is get to everybody. It must be able to absorb people's memories, gain a certain amount of understanding that they have for the Thing to imitate everybody. So it must gain the understanding that there's a whole world outside of Antarctica full of people and animals for it to assimilate and just take over the planet. So it would definitely not do anything to decrease the chance of getting off of that snowy hell.
But there is a scene when Blair's been locked away for a while where he is creating a spaceship, or it is creating a spaceship. So somewhere in there, somebody got to Blair and assimilated him, and that's why I wonder if he was all along. But I don't think that I'm right about that. I always thought maybe he was supposed to be the Thing way back in one of those scenes, including the one where he is trying to break everything apart and using the axe and using a gun. But you're right, I don't think that's true now, analyzing it further. But at some point, he was turned into the Thing. And we know that because he assimilates Gary, the last time we know for sure that somebody gets attacked by the Thing.
with the hand going to the mouth. I mean, it's a really cool shot, but it makes no logical sense. Some of the body horror stuff is really cool, but you kind of have to check all logic at the door when you consider how could... Who is it who their gut turns into a mouse?
That's Norris.
Norris. How could all that have been happening and just ready to go? All of his organs turn into this weird giant chomping thing, and he doesn't even have a gut rot. He doesn't even appear to be uncomfortable, and all this is happening to his body. You can't survive while that's going on inside of you. You know, whatever. I'm totally nitpicking for the sake of nitpicking. Who cares when then it becomes this cool monster, or like my personal favorite, the upside down head spider. Good work, guys.
That whole scene's awesome, right from the point where the doctor gets his arms cut off until, you've got to be fucking kidding me. And then they attack with a blowtorch.
Kill it with fire.
Rob Bottin made the creature effects in this film. He was 22 during this movie. He was a goddamn kid.
Oh my God.
He was overworked. He was living in the studio, and they talk about it on the making of. It's one of the better making ofs out there, actually. It's a great one. I've watched it two or even three times. And it's funny how much he giggles about it now, and I'm sure he was actually stressed to the max. And Stan Winston, the infamous effects and makeup guy, did help out, but he's very careful to say he's on the making of as well. I didn't do very much, guys. This isn't like I took over and did all the effects for Rob. It was his movie. I think he only helped out with one of the dog creature effects. It may have been early
on.
Yeah,
they were just running out of time, so he needed to delegate, but it's his vision.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of effects, there's very convincing matte paintings, and I like those when they show the enormous spaceship. Again, the making of, you see these guys on a little strip of fake snow, and the rest of it's just a great painting. And that's one thing you really miss in modern movies, because special effects are better now, although sometimes you see the strings more than you did back then, even though there are more strings that could have been seen, including painting on a glass, and they make it look like it's some spaceship or a mountain or a forest or whatever you're supposed to be creating. And there may be more KY jelly in this movie than even in the Alien films. There's so much slime.
That's how you make things really visceral, you know? That's how you make a monster go from scary or cool to gross, like something that really gets under your skin and makes you creeped out.
In some ways, it makes more sense than in the Alien movies because it's pulling apart cells and all that kind of deal. So if it's not going to be blood, it probably should be something like KY jelly-ish type of a substance.
It's like something that comes from a body. It looks like a bodily fluid.
Mm. They shot the cold scenes on refrigerated sets during a heat wave, and of course they did the same thing in The Exorcist. I don't know if it was during a heat wave, but there's also more talk in the making of about how these guys would go out with their parkas to go have lunch and makeup effects, and it would freak people out. What's with that guy? Although, do you think people on movie studios lots would realize if somebody's got some weird makeup on their face or their arm or whatever, they're probably shooting a movie and they're just having a sandwich in the meantime.
I work in a television studio, and I see people in full elaborate costumes all the time. It becomes commonplace before you know it.
But that must have been very uncomfortable, especially in the middle of LA, to be in a refrigerated set all day long. All right, the brilliant blood test scene, the best scene in the whole movie, and Hitchcock would be so proud of the suspense in this one. And it does end with that great line, "Fellas, I know we've all been a little tired and stressed out, but I don't want to spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch." Great line by Gary, Donald Moffat.
That's a great line, but I think my favorite line, the most effective line in the whole sequence, is when Gary and MacReady are kind of fighting. They butt heads through the whole film, and MacReady is about to test, the names, someone else's blood.
The one who actually is
the one who actually is the thing at that point. Palmer, right. So he's about to test Palmer's blood, but Kim and Gary are fighting, and he's like, "That's why I'm going to test you last, Gary." And you're like, "Oh, that's going to be the big one." But then that's the second he puts the copper wire in the blood, and we discover that it was Palmer all along who was the thing. Another reasonably good question. Well, actually, like, I have this whole issue for why MacReady was put in charge of anything. Childs wants to be in charge, and they're like, "I don't think so, Childs. You and your short temper." 3 hours later, MacReady is threatening everybody with dynamite, ties them up, and it's not even just that he's irrationally angry and a totalitarian, but that he makes the stupid decision to tie people up next to one another so that when Palmer is revealed to be the thing, he has a perfect opportunity to attack whoever's next to him, and he does and kills him. But then even after that, he doesn't separate them. He leaves them tied up together. You don't know how many things are there. And he kills Clark, and Clark wasn't infected.
That's right. Yeah, Richard Mason, who acts a little too weird, I think, considering he's supposed to be a human. And he's, another reasonably good question, around that dog for a long time. Why didn't the Norwegian dog try to duplicate Clark? It's the way it works. You even see it go into the room, and it's supposed to be that Clark is the one in there. Although I was reading online that that wasn't one of the actors in the movie. They just used somebody else. It wasn't any of the actors, so that it couldn't be determined who that was. but it's implied that it's Clark, and the dog walks in, and you fade to black. A lot of fades in this movie, by the way. It's an interesting technique. We'll get to the editing in a few minutes. But why is Clark so weird, and why isn't he the thing where he really should be? One of the great things about the blood test sequence is the shot before the freak out with the blood, because they know that, or at least they figure, that fire is going to make the thing react badly. If you look closely, you'll see it's a fake hand holding a little petri dish of blood. They show it beforehand, though, so you get used to the fact that it's supposed to be Kurt Russell's hand. It's one of those deals that most people who watch a movie are never going to pick up on. You have to be a movie fan to pick up on that in the first place. But I like that they show it before the freakout moment happens with the blood. It's one of the other guys that doesn't actually have the thing inside of him. And the next time you see that, the line you talk, well, Gary, that's what I figured we'll do you last. And Gary, by the way, is their leader. So he is being upstaged completely. It's one of those great things in a movie like this where he's almost giving up his power. Most movies like this are a deliberate battle of power between the man of action like a Kurt Russell, who isn't actually supposed to be in charge, and the guy who is in charge. But the guy in charge, Gary, doesn't seem to even really want to be. Although they all say, maybe Norris should be in charge. Guys, I appreciate that, but I'm not up to it right now. And of course, he has the heart attack. Well, the thing has the heart attack not long after. There you go. Does Norris know he's the thing? I guess he must, because I don't know if he's supposed to be separated. But there's also a time situation in this movie. It could be that it's been many days that go by between some of the red letter scenes in the film. Not the blood test scene towards the end. At that point, I think we're looking at pretty much real time, give or take. But up to that point, it could be that there's been a day or two that passes, and God knows what happened in the meantime.
It's pretty vague about how much time passes. We do get the impression that when things start getting really ugly is also when they're all extremely sleep-deprived, and of course, paranoia, you're afraid to go to sleep. So they've been up for days at that point, and we're not really sure how many days.
And one of them is very drunk. This is also a perfect example of where you should never split up, and that is a horror movie staple, but of course they do split up because otherwise there would be no movie.
Oh, and here's a reasonably good question. Isn't it just like a pretty straightforward, easy way to determine if somebody's an imposter or not, just to ask them a question that only they would know the answer to? Hey, what did you and I argue about last week? And then...
No, I think it's supposed to be the thing has all of your memories, because how else would it know people's names?
Yeah, that's a pretty sophisticated parasite, man.
Well, sure, but let's just say you and I, one of us went outside, and I got the thing inside of me to come back inside. I haven't said your name in a while today. Like I said, it all day today, so it's not going to know your name is Bev. So the end game of this movie is not survival, and they all know that. Again, great touch, but very nihilistic. Is burning down the entire camp just a make-work project and a big waste of time? I guess if you supposedly get the thing trapped somewhere and you make sure you're not it, although how can you really prove you're not it?
And like I said, you could be infected and it could be working its way through your system and you wouldn't know yet, necessarily. You might just think you have a headache, but really there's a creature growing itself inside your brain, inside your skull, and it'll look like you die of a heart attack, and then it'll emerge in that nice, beautiful, creepy, half-created way with like eyeballs and tufts of hair everywhere. So MacReady, for all we know, at the very end, we assume that he's not. We think he is MacReady and that he still is in control of his body, but that doesn't mean that he isn't already infected to the point of no return, and that isn't inevitable that he will become the thing as well. And truly, if you want to save the human race, he's got to set them both on fire.
They shot an ending I was reading where Mac is rescued and is proven to be human.
I read that it was the editor's suggestion to shoot that ending so that they would have it. But then when the film was done, Carpenter never included that in any versions of the screenings that they did for test screenings, because he just didn't want some exec to say, oh, they loved it, make it the happy ending, and thank God they didn't. Because I think it's the nihilistic bad ending that puts the film over the top and makes it really interesting and good and elevates it above the other films that it shares so many similarities with.
And Carpenter's previous film with Russell was Escape from New York, and that's a nihilistic movie at the end too, because Russell saves the day, but then the president is given the wrong tape. It's supposed to be something that'll save the whole world and bring us all together, but he switches out the tape and deliberately ruins the one that's some kind of cold fusion or some kind of power source, whatever it was. But he deliberately ruins the future in that movie, Russell does, and in this movie, he's part of another one where it's supposed to be that maybe the whole world's fucked. So I guess the ending of both cases makes sense. It certainly fits Carpenter's vision. And I think if he made either one of those movies now, and they're talking about remaking Escape from New York, they probably shouldn't, they will have at least one more scene. They might have what they think is a nihilistic ending, but I have a feeling there'd be one last scene in that that makes you think, oh, it could all be all right after all. There are lots of modern movies that do play the same game as this one. We talked about it with The Ring, where at the end, it isn't really over. Get out. It isn't really over when the movie ends.
There's something so gutsy about a bad ending, a sad ending, where the hero, at least in some capacity, loses. And of course, we hope, we assume that MacReady, while he'll die was successful in eliminating the thing, so there's that element of hope, but there is something so subversive about killing your hero.
And it's a surprisingly quiet and inconclusive ending for a horror film or a sci-fi picture, although I guess Halloween had the same kind of deal, because Michael Myers is defeated, he's shot, but he's not actually dead because he got up and walked away. Carpenter was a very cynical guy in his prime. I guess he still is now. All right, the cast. A lot of these old codgers are still alive. Wilford Brimley still is. Donald Moffat, who plays Gary, and Richard Macer, whatever it is, who plays Clark, are all still going. Kurt Russell still is, too. But I mean, these guys are older than the rest of those guys. And speaking of Kurt Russell, there have been a lot of big gaps in his career. It's too bad because he's one of the unsung heroes of modern cinema. He's been so great for so long. He worked with Carpenter on the Elvis TV movie, Escape from New York, this, Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York 2, and nothing since. But when they do commentaries together on Escape from New York and The Thing and so on, they're so much fun together, and they obviously have a lot of affection for each other after all these years. The role could have been played by Nick Nolte, Harrison Ford, Jeff Bridges, Clint Eastwood, probably a lot of other big names, but I think they went the right way. I think Bridges would have been good in this, and Ford probably would have been. Nolte might have been actually the best of all those guys if it wasn't going to be Russell, but they made the right move going with Russell, I think, in the end.
There's a couple of ties between The Thing and The Hateful Eight, which Kurt Russell's also in.
Back in the Snow.
Yeah, Back in the Snow, another people trapped in a enclosed space, they can't go anywhere, and they know that somebody's probably a traitor or a danger, a villain, but they don't know who, and they're trying to figure it out. And Ennio Morricone scored The Hateful Eight.
And won an Oscar for it.
But they actually used tracks that were written for The Thing that never got used in The Thing.
Okay. Morricone's worked on 373 movies, according to the IMDb. 373.
Most well, of those... it's like John Williams has a huge number of films too, right?
Not that many, I don't think.
Oh, really? He did a lot of B-films too, Ennio Morricone.
Well, and he worked a lot with Sergio Leone. That's probably what he's most known for. But then this movie where he got... I can't believe that Razzie. Anyway, so back to the actors. Keith David's done 139 movies. His next film after this, though, was Platoon. All right. 1982, The Thing. 1986, Platoon. Good performance in this movie. Pretty decent-looking guy. That great voice. An Emmy-winning voice. In fact, if you look up his credits... he's won, I think, 3 Emmys for voiceovers, and yet 4 years it took for him to get another job. But then it was a Best Picture winner, and also, well, this wasn't, but a big hit. He's very good in the film, and he's maybe the last character, not man, the last character standing if he is a thing, because he's probably going to assimilate Russell or kill him.
Or let him just die in the snow and then freeze himself and wait for the rescue people to assimilate them.
What a long con. They say that spaceship was under the ice for hundreds of thousands of years.
I think in the novel it's like millions of years, and in this one it's like 100,000.
It's still a long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even 10 years would be a long time. Land near the equator, dummy. T.K. Carter is Knowles. He was in Runaway Train and then later played Cosby, as in Bill Cosby, in Badass. And despite Cosby's recent troubles, that's a pretty good performance by T.K. Carter. We mentioned Palmer, David Clennon, who is the guy who has the thing in him during the infamous blood test scene. He was in Being There, Gone Girl. We mentioned Richard Dysart, who's in Back to the Future 3, which I watched not long ago. By the way, an amputee played him in his death scene. They talk about that also in the making of, where his arms get cut off and it's still him, but then there's a wide shot with a guy flailing around. You're like, how do they do that? Well, he's had an amputee play him with a mask on his face. And it's a very brief shot, and of course you're focused on the stumps for arms that he's got left. So in one quick, probably less than a second shot, it's an amputee playing a great move. And of course, Spielberg used amputees in Saving Private Ryan, covered up the fact they were amputees with fake legs, then blew those fake legs off and made it look like they lost their legs.
So many effective practical effects in this movie.
Charles Hallahan is Norris. He wanted to do TV shows and Twilight Zone movie. He was in that too. Richard Macer, whatever the fuck his name is, he was the dad in License to Drive. That's what I'll always remember him for.
I
saw License to Drive before I saw The Thing.
Oh my God.
It'll always be that. And the polar opposite character. Crush on Corey Haim, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then Thomas Waits is Windows. He's the one that Palmer attacks when he freaks out in the blood test scene. He was a key character in Injustice for All a few years before. There's just a pretty good movie by Al Pacino, but also the movie that Al Pacino became the madman in, where he was screaming over the top. He wasn't really like that until Injustice for All. Okay, their director, John Carpenter, who has always been an unsung hero, just like Kurt Russell in the business, he said something about how he's revered in this place and respected in this place, but he's a bum in America. And maybe that isn't true anymore. He's one of those guys that's respected more now. That was true about Hitchcock. He wasn't really respected in his day. Despite some Oscar nominations for Hitchcock, he wasn't really thought of as the genius that people say he is now. We talked about his credits already. Halloween, Escape from New York are the two big ones along with The Thing. His last movie was The Ward in 2010, so I guess maybe he has full-on retired now, even though he's younger than people like Spielberg. And Scorsese, I think, too. They're still making movies. This was apparently his favorite of his own films, and it's one of his most ambitious and also probably the most dreary. He wasn't exactly a positive filmmaker, but this movie, as great as it is quite dreary. He didn't like the poster, despite the fact it's an iconic, famous poster, and I think people have probably seen it before. I'll probably use it as the picture for the podcast page. He felt it looked like a typical horror villain in a suit, even though Drew Struzan, who's very well respected in this kind of poster-making business, did that great shot.
It's a man standing in a snowsuit, and he's silhouetted by a light behind him, and he has this bright blue light coming from his face, like where his face would be. It's a really cool image, mm-hmm. but I kind of agree, and I was thinking about this when I was looking at it, when I was doing research for the podcast, that it's a great image, but I don't think it's really a thematic match with the film. I don't think it really implies what the film is about or, like, espouses any of the themes.
Yeah, it's not really any light in the movie, per se.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a really cool image.
The writer was Bill Lancaster, who is Bert's son, and he based it on John Campbell's story. This is more faithful to the Campbell story than the 1951 thing is, and I think a lot of people have probably seen the 1951 thing. It was on the Top 100 Thrills. It was 87th, and like I said, this wasn't even nominated for the Thrills list.
It was directed by Howard Hawks.
Mm-hmm. That has that one great moment where the thing, it's more of a plant-like type thing, but it bursts into their station, and it's a great scare moment, and they set it ablaze. That's probably the only real good thrill in the whole film, though, and this one definitely has more than that one did, but that's the one that people, at least then, respected more.
I have to give a shout-out to a film that's set in Antarctica. I cannot think of one other example of a film that's primarily set in Antarctica, but I have a soft spot for any movie that's really wintry, where, like, snow and cold are a big component of it.
Simple Plan, good
example. Simple Plan, Fargo, of course, is an excellent example. I love The Edge, which isn't all in snow, but there's certainly a nice wintry component to it. And I guess it's just because it is such an unusual choice for a director to make, for good reason. Oh, The Shining, of course, my favorite movie. And I was trying to think of, why do I love snowy movies? Like, what is it that I find so appealing? And I guess it's just that it is such an unusual thing to see. I understand why directors, filmmakers, and producers would be very discouraged from shooting films in wintry settings and snowy settings. It's terrible for the crew and the actors. It's terrible for equipment. There's logistical nightmares coming out of the wazoo. So maybe it's the novelty factor that I like. And it's funny that I would like it at all because, as a Canadian, I hate winter. I hate snow. I don't care how pretty it is. But for some reason in movies, I find it so deeply appealing. So many of movies I love take place in the winter.
And back in 1982, it was harder to make a movie in the snow, whether it be fake snow or real snow. Because if it's fake, then you've got an awful lot of prep work to do. And you have to worry about messing up the cameras and this and that, with that kind of stuff, getting in the cameras.
That was in The Shining. That was salt they used to stand in for
right.
snow, and it
and
was a nightmare.
And that's melting people's boots in that case, yeah. Or you go to a place with actual snow, and then you run the risk, just like water, where you run the risk of actually not being able to literally film because you have all these problems.
Or like in Fargo, where snow kept melting. It was an unseasonably warm winter. They would have to like try and move snow around and make it look consistent. But they did shoot this in real snow. They shot this in northern British Columbia, where they said there was guaranteed snow, and it was guaranteed cold. You see the actors' breath. They froze their butts off making this movie.
Not that many scenes are actually set outside anyway. They just had to get some establishing shots. I remember Leo DiCaprio said in his Oscar acceptance speech, which is a great one, by the way, about how they had to go further and further north just to find, or south, I guess, way down, just to find snow to make the movie The Revenant.
Keep going further south?
Well, you go far enough south and you get to the Antarctic, the South Pole.
That's where they shot The Revenant.
Well, he may have said, I think he said something about that. The point is, both poles is where the snow is always going to
be. Yeah, yeah.
The producers were David Foster and Lawrence Terman. They both worked on the prequel, which we haven't talked about yet, from 2011, so The Thing in 2011. Terman also was a producer on The Graduate, a movie we covered way back when. The movie's 2.35:1. We watched the Blu-ray, which we've had for years. I'm a big fan of Universal Blu-rays, by the way. I think they're great packaging. I love the main menu and all that kind of stuff. Get Out was also a Universal Blu-ray. The cinematographer, you mentioned him, Dean Cundey, who shot Halloween for Carpenter, and then Back to the Future, a couple years after this, and Jurassic Park. What a great resume he's got going there, and many other movies, of course, too. And just like in Jurassic Park, life, even violent, assimilating life, finds a way. Even though there are plenty of early exterior shots, there aren't that many as the movie goes along. It does feel very claustrophobic and paranoid as it goes along, of course. The editor, Todd Ramsey, who did a lot of fades, and that was a controversial choice, too, to see fades to black. You didn't really see that in movies all that much back then. He cut Escape from New York for Carpenter and Star Trek The Motion Picture before that. So the editing, you're an editor. What'd you think?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's perfect. The tension builds up. Doesn't get better than this. He takes his time. Like, it's a risky thing to do, or it can feel like a risky thing to do. And it's really hard when you're in that edit bay and you know what's coming and you know what's going to happen to really stay inside the mind of an audience and to just instinctually know what's going to work for somebody watching it for the first time. And I think that's probably why a lot of films end up rushing scenes like the blood testing scene. This is the work of a master.
And kind of like Jaws, where maybe the pace is a little bit slow, but they build to those big moments with the dog freakout scene where they're all getting burned because they're being assimilated by the thing. Or the moment where the first guy becomes the thing, or Blair's freak out, and of course the blood testing scene. There are peaks and valleys, but there are an awful lot of valleys. In modern movies, there aren't as many valleys as there probably need to be.
They give in to the temptation to rush it.
There isn't that much influence from the thing that I could find. I talk about the 2011 prequel, and of course the 1982 version is a remake of the 1951 movie. And of the three of them, this one's definitely the best one, I would say. Most people probably agree, although I guess a lot of old-timers might say the 51 version. And it was released the same day as Blade Runner. And I did say the same day. Also a sci-fi cult classic that was also hated at the time, but respected very much now. In fact, as much as E.T. is popular still, was then, it is now. For example, the IMDb, Blade Runner and The Thing are on the top 250, and E.T. is not. Not even close,
it's
really.
Not?
E.T. is about 7.8. These two movies are in the 8.2 range, wow. Blade Runner and The Thing. Well, there you go. What's your favorite of all those movies, then?
E.T.
That's the one I would want to watch the most, yeah. For sure. And I like The Thing a lot. I've seen it probably 5 or 6 or even more times, but it's not my favorite this year.
One of my favorite things I saw, because there's a couple things, like there's some novelizations, a comic series of sequels to the movie, but my favorite thing that I found was that this writer, Peter Watts, wrote a short story called The Things, which redoes the film from the alien's point of view as a creature who's just trying to commune. The creature communing is this great gift that they share on their home planet, and he just wants to share his experiences with these strange beings and is alarmed to be met with their antagonism.
It's like the Borg then, like I said earlier.
From the point of view of the Borg, they're like trying to do good and they don't understand why anybody fights them. And in this short story, the alien is taking it rather personally and is very saddened by the human's reaction.
Hmm.
I thought that was such a cool little thing.
Another thing this movie compares to, of course, is Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Big time.
Both the original and the remake were before The Thing came out. And they both have that great sound when someone opens their mouth. It's Fuchs when he hasn't been assimilated properly and they burn him, but then also at the very end, the last shot, in fact, of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Spoiler alert! Donald Sutherland has that great noise as he points and screams at Veronica Cartwright. It's a very short awards and list section. There's no AFI stuff to talk about at all, and Morricone's Razzie nomination, Burns. The score, by the way, is very John Carpenter-esque, too. He approved it, obviously. It's the kind of score he would have done, so if you don't like the music that Morricone did, and you don't like John Carpenter's music scores, he usually did them on a keyboard, and he had been doing since Halloween, maybe even before Halloween, for that matter. But then that was one of the first ones that people really took notice. He wrote that very simple music score for that movie. This is similar, and yet it was pissed on.
Yeah, he composes most of his own scores. He had begun to compose a score for The Thing, but when Morricone came on, he gave him total autonomy. Morricone has said that, you know, he asked for his input and he just stepped away, didn't want anything to do with it. He told him he hired him because he got married, like walked down the aisle, to a piece of Morricone's score. I didn't catch what movie it was from, but yeah, right.
Wah, wah, wah.
That would be a strange nuptial choice, but he's obviously a super fan and that's why he couldn't bring himself to come in and tell him what to do.
Okay. Here comes the bride. So there were no Oscar nominations, like we said, but how about for visual effects? The three nominees that year were E.T., Blade Runner, and Poltergeist. Poltergeist may be the worst of those three, not that it's a bad choice, but maybe either have 5 nominees or bump up Poltergeist, because I can't really say E.T. and Blade Runner shouldn't have been nominated, and The Thing probably should have been 2. But then the bigger one is makeup. Quest for Fire won, and they did a good job on makeup with making these guys look a prehistoric man, and Gandhi was nominated, I guess, making Ben Kingsley looked like Gandhi. But again, have more than 2 goddamn nominees. Rob Bottin should have been at the show, whether he walked down the aisle and got an award or not, even though he was a kid.
I think that's just the way that horror is ghettoized in Hollywood.
All right, well, the last thoughts on The Thing.
Like I've said, I've always really enjoyed The Thing. The buildup of suspense is second to none. Kurt Russell is at his Kurt Russelliest best. Smart, fun, it's adeptly made. But it's always also left me just a little bit cold, perhaps because it leaves a little to be desired as far as character development, perhaps because all the machismo leaves me feeling a little alienated. You're welcome. So it's never been in my pantheon of the greats, but it's damn fun.
I'm a big fan of the movie too, and of course I picked it. We want to do The Ring and The Thing. But as far as scares go, it's not really scary, I guess, between Get Out, The Ring, and The Thing. And then The Babadook, which we do next week, we've got 2 really bona fide horror films and then 2 that are more sci-fi, really. Thriller. Get Out and The Thing, both. Yeah. Sci-fi thrillers, yeah. But it's a damn good film, and you said Russell is at his rustliest best. He is one of my favorite actors. When I think about the guys I like the best, he doesn't come up in the top five necessarily, but every time I see him, I like him. He's a damn good performer, and it's too bad he hasn't acted more in the last 15 or 20 years, because he has taken those huge gaps. And he and Carpenter are a great team together. Too bad Carpenter gave up on making movies, because if he's going to make any more, do one more with Kurt Russell. When we conclude Scary Movie Month next week, we'll tackle a lady-driven fright fest with, oh, a few dozen layers of subtext. The Babadook. Babadook.
He's trying to scare me right now. That's what's happening there. Right now.
You should do that tonight when you're in bed and I've still stayed
you
up
later. Don't you dare.
I won't. The coming attraction trivia for The Babadook. Babadook is an anagram for what? And a hint, it's relevant to the plot.
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about the Babadook. And if you just can't wait that long to hear from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project. We're on iTunes, and while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. But while you're there, if you would like to repay us, we would love it if you would rate us and review us. That means a lot. It really helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. And don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's one word, TOP100PROJECT, not case sensitive.
Okay, we're done, so let's get off of this fucking couch!
And cut.